The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Unfiltered opinions.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
Does he secure the bag?
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Moyaha.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to Insider Exchange. Welcome to a new week. Hopefully it is a productive week. We'll see what happens by Wednesday because it is that week, folks. Budget 3.0. Yes, the third time might just be the charm. We're going to try and avoid looking at that because we don't know. Maybe there'll be a fourth budget and then we have to look at that. So we're going to wait it out for this time around. We're going to let the third budget happen on Wednesday. Then we'll come back to it next week and see what we make of that third budget and what announcements are coming through later in the week. But what we are going to be taking a look at in Market Matters is we're going to be taking a look at the first ratings downgrade, or the last ratings downgrade, technically speaking, but the first time by Moody's of the United States. The first time in history that Moody's has downgraded the United States from a AAA to, I think it's A plus or AA plus. Right. We're going to look at that.
AA1. Because Moody's.
Because it's Moody's. We're going to look at the implications of that. We're going to look at what that means for the United States and this historic moment and what it means for the rest of the world. We're also going to look at the Rand. Decided to flirt with 17 Rand 99 or sub 18 Rand levels last week. Is back at 18 Rand and 1 cent this morning. We're going to take a look at that and see what we make of it. And then we're going to take a look at some other economic data coming out later this week, in the form of interest rates out of China, CPI data out of South Africa, and CPI data out of Europe, if we have time. Si, let's start with the historic downgrade of the United States. This is something that S&P and Fitch did many, many years
ago. S&P did it in August of 2011, and there was huge panic.
So 14 odd years ago, almost.
13 and a half years. And at the time, I mean, our market was down some 2,000 points on the Monday, because to their credit, they always do it after market close on Friday, so that everyone gets a moment to reflect. And US futures, which is dodgy because it's 5 o'clock in the morning in the US, S&P down 1 1/3, NASDAQ 1 3/4, Dow less than 1, all in the red. So Moody's did it, when Standard & Poor's rather did it, it was wild. It was a freak out. It was absolutely like, whoa, hang on, this is the end of the world. By the time Fitch came along in 23 to do it, 2 years ago, it was like, where York's been for the last 12 years? And now Moody's is always late. I mean, they were the last to put us into junk status as well, etc. I think it's symbolic. I mean, what they state is rising debt and deficits is the main reason, debt to GDP ratios rising to levels significantly higher than similarly rated sovereigns, i.e., guys, you're almost a banana republic at these levels. I think it's symbolic, but I do, you know, US isn't defaulting on their debt, although there has been the idea of a Mar-a-Lago accord floated, which would in part effectively be a default, just change term durations and stuff. So I think it's important. America has a problem. They've got a $30 trillion debt burden. Their interest payment is up about 3 or 4 fold in the last 4 years or so. Their interest payment is now more every year than they spend on defense, which is by a long way their biggest spending item. And there's really good old fashioned only two ways to get out of this: spend less or tax more. And
we know they're not interested in doing either. Especially spend less, because if I remember correctly, they've just increased their defense budget. And I think it might be for the first time in a long time, it's now going back above $1 trillion to be spent on defense. Kind of makes sense when you are waging war against everybody in the world. But I want to look at you said it's symbolic. And I want to look at the symbolism in the context of, at the same time, over the same weekend. Now, this is completely unrelated, folks, but you may as well mention it if it's good. S&P coming out and revising South Africa's rating. When, I mean, this is one of those events, and we spoke about this on a couple of shows ago, saying black swan events that happen once in a lifetime. This is probably one of those once in a lifetime events.
S&P didn't change us. They left us at positive, yes. And everyone thought they would change us to neutral.
But we're still in junk status. Let's be clear. That hasn't changed. But it is slightly more optimistic and slightly more positive at the same time as it is slightly more negative in the United States. Yeah. I never thought I'd be alive to see that day happen. But again, let's be clear, we are nowhere near being out of the woods.
Yeah, and I mean, for us, it does matter because we need to get out of sub-investment grade. And we're a long way from that, but we desperately need to get out of it. And we are moving in the right direction. I think all the rating agencies have us on positive outlook, etc. Truth is, we're not defaulting on our debt either. Where this hurts you and where it's been hurting us for the last many years since we became sub-investment grade, otherwise affectionately known as junk, is the rate on your bonds. Mm. It blows your rates out. Although, interestingly, Brazil went junk before us and their bonds were always cheaper than ours. Their 10 years and stuff, I could just never wrap my head around it. But we're seeing it in the US 10-year, 4.544. So fun fact, when it hit 4.5 on the 8th of April this year, Trump blinked and cancelled Liberation Day. But he can't. Well, I mean, what can he cancel this time? He's run out of...
He's
got no cards.
No, don't say
him
that.
And Zelensky.
Don't say that. Some of the cards that he's been playing, we didn't know he had in the first place. Well, he can always find new cards.
He can find new cards.
Don't put that out there into the world.
I mean, so fun fact. So Brazil 10-year... Whoa, okay, that's changed. Brazil 10-year is at 14. That's well above us. Okay, because forever in a day, the Brazilian 10-year was cheaper than ours. Mm. And it has... Oh, looky. We're looking more pretty. Anyway, the key thing is that it matters. Because it's saying to the world, in a sense, that the days of America being the economic superpower are eroding. They're not over, and maybe it's only the end of the beginning or the whatever.
Beginning of the end or something of the
like that. It's not over, but it is not unimportant, and it is the stark reality. And I mean, I was chatting with Nikunza this morning about it, and the short answer is no one's surprised. Mm. I mean, no one's out there saying, what's Moody's doing? When S&P did it, they were surprised. There was panic. There were, you know, I remember brokers sending out emails over the weekend on how they were going to manage the next morning. And it wasn't actually as ugly as many had thought, myself included. But it is, it's a shot across the bow.
But I think it's also not that ugly because at the end of the day, the dollar is still the reserve trade currency in the world. And so therefore, that is kind of balancing it out. I mean, you still have a demand for dollars that is being created. And I guess that's probably why America wants to maintain that defensive position, because the moment you see a decline in the demand for dollar coupled with this, it means then that obviously the ratings on government bonds in America is going to be affected. So as long as you've still got demand for the currency or demand for the treasuries or whatever, you're still kind of in good stead. But nobody can deny that the $34+ trillion of US debt is a lot.
And I mean, the dollar last Monday, dollar index was 102. This morning it's 100.3. That's a big move in just a week.
And the rand.
I want to
look at the rand, because the rand started off the month. We're almost done with the month. We're about 2/3 of the way into the month. And the rand at some point was at 1850. It has touched 1799 last week. It is back at 1801, 1802-ish as I look at it now. The rand absolutely benefiting from, one, the S&P announcement, but two, from the fact that global markets are saying, hang on, maybe the dollar isn't...
Yeah. And on Liberation Day, or was it Liberation Day, or was it the capitulation? On Capitulation Day, the rand was almost 20. It was 1980, and in fact, 1990 and some change. So the rand's moved 10% in 6 weeks, which again is insane moves. So we can see two things from the market. People are selling US debt. That's why the yield is up at 4.544. And they're taking the money out of the US and going somewhere else. At the moment, they're coming into the Tsar. Now, truthfully, the Tsar started moving last week on news, I think, from Deputy Finance Minister that we were going to be doing a review of our inflation targeting process, which truthfully scares me, because what they're going to do is they're going to move inflation and say, new target is, I don't know, 2%, and inflation is currently 2.7, so we're going to rise rates. I should have said that more quietly.
Okay.
Shouldn't give anyone ideas. But it is.
And we have our rates meeting next week, Si. We have a rates meeting on the 29th.
There's a lot happening. Hey?
There's a lot happening.
Budget
this week,
rates at the White
next
House.
Week. Oh, there's a lot.
I hope Ramaphosa took lots of decks of cards.
I don't know if they're a card playing kind of. I found it interesting that he's decided to travel with certain ministers, and I looked at the ministers, and there was one in particular that I was just like, why? Just why? But that's...
And his token white. Steenhuisen.
Agricultural minister. Mm.
Ah, oh, well. Maybe he's there for agri. I thought he was the token white.
No. No, he's there for agri.
Actually, hang on, that fits, right? Because the farmers that ran away were being persecuted. And now the minister of farming, who weirdly is white, is going to say, no, they're not. It's going to be such a messy meeting. Yo, I'm going to go to bed early that day.
Well, to be fair, it can't really... I mean, it's interesting that the meeting happens to coincide with the week that we are having our third budget speech. I don't know if people...
We've also got inflation on Tuesday.
Yes, inflation on Tuesday.
Is it Tuesday? It's Tuesday.
Budget speech on Wednesday. Rates the following Thursday. Let's look at inflation while we have time for that. Inflation prints from Eurozone coming out as well. Our own inflation print coming out. But before that, we've got Chinese interest rates that'll be coming out in the early hours of the mornings. We know that China's kind of been trying to stimulate their economy, but not really trying, but also trying. And are we expecting a major announcement from a rates perspective?
I think not. A couple of things. So we had some data out from China this morning, which is Monday 19. Retail sales year on year down a little, but not bad. Housing price index down 4%, but previous was 4.5%. These are year on year numbers. Unemployment 5.1, which is fine. Industrial production up 6.1, better than expected. Fixed asset investment 4%, slightly down. But I think the data coming out of China is good enough. And I think the fact that we have some trade peace in our time, and to be clear, 30%, which is the one trade side for Chinese goods into America, still is about the highest number since Smoot-Hawley 100 years ago. I think the Chinese government can hold steady for now. They've been doing a big push on the consumption side. Remember the cash flow for clunkers that Obama did post-grad financial crisis. They've been doing like cash for toasters and stuff. No, literally, take your own toaster and upgrade to... They're trying to get consumption going.
Yes.
Part of what they do there is Chinese people save because they don't have health insurance, they don't have pension schemes, and they're bringing those into the process and saying, et cetera, et cetera, so that people will save less and spend more and try and get consumption going.
There is a really big culture of saving in China. That's something perhaps we should look at in one of the deep dives is how they kind of maintain that ecosystem. It's something that we've also heard some Chinese officials come out and say as well. When we had the trade war conversations, there were a couple of individuals and business people from the Chinese side of things that said, we're not too bothered by being tariffed because from our side, we've been saving. When we start spending money, we are spending money that we have saved. We're not spending debt.
And it's weird because Japan also has a massively high savings rate.
Mm.
Japan, because of the deflation, which was, well, if you wait a year, it would be cheaper.
Yeah.
So people waited because they have good healthcare and old age and everything else. China is the opposite. They've got inflation. Their freak out is worrying about what do they do in retirement? What happens if they get sick? Things like Ping An, which is discovery held, 25% discovery held, is to try and bring that in, you know, the concept of medical insurance and the like to China. But other doctors, as you say, I mean, we've got our own CPI.
Mm-hmm.
What were we last time? 2.7.
Yes.
I mean, even core was 3.1.
So I want to take that 2.7 print and say, even if we come in this week and we come in at 2.9, maybe 3, that's the lower end of the 3 to 6% band.
And to be clear, the governor says 4.5.
Until the governor suddenly says we can do 3, or the governor suddenly says we should look at 2.5 as an anchoring point.
So the story is that you want to change your inflation targeting, and I'm assuming you always want to change it lower. No one wants to change
No
it
one
higher.
Wants to change it higher, yeah.
You always want to change your inflation targeting when two environments are in existence. One, that you are in a rate reducing cycle, and that you are in an inflation reducing cycle. Ting, ting.
Tick, tick.
I think this is a debate. And I said it years ago, this is a debate we should have been having a while ago so that we could almost put measures at a parliamentary level, because this is going to have to go through parliament, that we could almost put triggers in that would say, here's the law, when these two things happen, or three things.
Confluencing factors, then therefore this thing.
And
this
maybe
triggers,
it's step.
Yes.
Maybe we go from 3 to 6 to 3.
Yes.
And then to, or maybe, you know, and then to 2.5.
Yeah, let's not shock the market.
Let's do it at gradual. But if we're in exactly the right place to change interest rates, inflation targeting. Rates are still far too high.
Yeah.
But we're at the right space to do it. But that process is going to take a bit of time.
And should we do it, I think the other thing that we need to think about as well is it's all good and well to want to do that. From a governor point of view, that is part of his mandate, is inflation targeting alongside currency protection, right? And he would be achieving that because because the moment you start to say we're anchoring inflation at a lower rate, thereby saying that we've got more control over inflation in our own economy, the rand's going to strengthen.
Yeah.
The rand's going to absolutely receive that positively.
If tomorrow the president, who's currently on his, in fact, by now he's in America, poor Oak, like he's leaving at like 11:30 last night and he's like having to have conversations with random, like I could not be president. Apart from that, the pay is probably crap, like what, 2.5 a year? I mean, nice money, don't get me wrong, yeah, but like you work for your money.
So Jimbo in our community is asking if we then do the, if we reduce inflation targeting, does that mean rates go higher for longer?
Well, not necessarily.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
So to your point, if we woke up tomorrow and the new inflation target is 3%, firstly, we're below it. Secondly, Rand is going to strengthen. And theoretically, maybe not, but in theory, Rand's going to strengthen. Market's going to rally. I mean, the Rand strengthened just on the news. Excuse me, our bond yields are going to come down, et cetera, et cetera. So suddenly our 2.7 inflation is actually going to start heading to 2.5, maybe, you know, so what they might do is they might pause rather than cut. But you know what I think they're going to do next week? I think they're going to pause anyway.
But so, and I think the other thing that we must look at from an inflation targeting point of view is the driving factors. There's demand side inflation, there's supply side inflation. And from a South African perspective, let's be clear, our inflation coming down to where it is not necessarily because all of the factors have been aligning in our favor. It's because our economy has been stagnating.
There's no demand.
There's no demand, right? So consumers are so stretched that they're saying we're not even spending on stuff because we don't have the money to spend on stuff. We're all focused on repaying debt. We're all focused on, and that's preventing demand side inflation. There is still supply side inflation in place. We're importing crude. We're a net importer of oil. So the fuel side of things always going to be there, and that's why they strip it out of things like core inflation. But our inflation number coming down to where it is because there's very little demand side in the
market. The only inflation we have in this market is services, Eskom, water, rates,
which is also being imposed again because the service, the increasing rates from Eskom are imposed by NERSA and applied for by Eskom. It's not voluntary. There's no consumer out there that voluntarily goes to Eskom and says, I want to pay a higher tariff. No, it's being imposed.
And the SOBS worry is a sudden collapse in the rand, which then absolutely hits us because oil goes through higher, and all our imports go higher, and that's what the Saab is worried about. And I appreciate our rand was what 1990, just on capitulation day, but like it's
but we survived.
18. We survived. I mean, I Saab is overly hawkish.
I think that from our perspective, the other thing that needs to be looked at is if we are to adjust inflation targeting, whilst the minister or whilst the governor will say this is a fantastic thing, this is a great time to do it for South Africa, he'll make a case for it, it'll go through Parliament and all of that. The one critical thing that Parliament fails to understand is other side of that coin means we need jobs, we need an economy that grows. You can't have an economy that goes into recession because when you adjust inflation targeting and things down in a recessionary environment, the market's already down. You're not really doing anyone a favor at that point. You need economic growth. That's still what we need at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It doesn't change. It doesn't suddenly be like,
more than anything, we don't need, more than anything, we need economic growth.
Jimbo asks, do we think that the Ramaphosa-Trump meeting will influence the Reserve Bank governor's decision?
No, I Reserve Bank, I don't think they have, I don't even think they have TV there, certainly. Although, no, the governor, oh, no, it was the previous governor who followed me on Twitter. Actually, I think Saab, no, it's Stats who follows me. Anyway, that was my claim to fame, that Mr. Mboweni followed me on Twitter and DM'd me once or twice.
Oh, nice.
Or maybe replied to, off track. No, I don't. Because Saab was always, we are data dependent. And then everyone's like, yeah, but guys, look at the data that you are ignoring. Then they're like, we're forward data dependent. We're looking at forward data. And we're like, yo, talk about a shifting of the goalposts. But be it as it may, that meeting on Wednesday, you know, even if it goes, I mean, what's you know, let's say it goes incredibly poorly and it's a Zelensky type
thing. What is the worst case scenario?
In the immediate, our rand will weaken. In the immediate, our bonds will get blown out. But you know what's going to happen? We're going to end up with some tariffs, which are nasty. But you know what? We're going to end up with tariffs anyway. Trump's going to say he's not coming to G20. I've been saying since January, Trump is not coming to G20 in November. There will be a short-term nasty, but in time it'll just shake out.
Yeah, I'm looking at the mechanics behind it and all of that. I mean, we already know that Trump is going to take a rather aggressive and abrasive stance, as he did with Vladimir Zelensky, as he does with leaders that he believes are doing the wrong things. And we know that from a pub- publicity point of view, he's going to go on and say, very bad things are happening in South Africa, terrible things are happening in South Africa, as he said in the past. Mm. And even as he has said that, the South African economy, the JSE continues to trade at all-time highs. The Rand continues to find its strength. Markets continue to say, we see your viewpoint, but we don't necessarily agree with it. Mm. So worst case scenario, we go through President Ramaphosa and President Trump don't see eye to eye. They don't reach a conclusion. It ends in an ugly manner. We all know President Ramaphosa is not going to say something out of turn. He'll come back. He'll come to South Africa. He'll say, we went to engage. We're still open to engagement. That's the kind of president he is. He's not going to respond in a knee-jerk.
He's not going to punch him.
That's it. Well,
hey, you mean
I don't know if you're that close. If you're that close, hey, if you're sitting that close to him.
But it's also, so we're not expecting anything good from it. Anything good that comes out of that meeting is a bonus and our market will love it. So the expectations are not there. We know that there are bad things happening in South Africa. We live here. We also know that it's not white genocide. Yeah. To be quite clear, white man here, not being genocided. We also know that the rest of the world looks at Trump and thinks, yeah, look, dude, liar, liar, face on fire.
That could be from a bad tan as well. But I think what you said is quite important, Sai, is we're going into this week, whether it's from a budget perspective, whether it's from a Trump perspective, with little to no expectations. And that's a strength that South Africans have always had. We've always been resilient and been able to take a lot of drama that comes our way and has put us in a position where we don't have expectations. And whatever comes of it, comes of it, we'll deal with it then. That might be a very one of the few times that it works in our favor, I want to say.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, we'll see how it works out. We'll see how...
Before you go.
Yeah.
Cecil, 71, 38.
Oh, yeah.
Good daily chart, good weekly chart. Capital Markets Day tomorrow.
Oh, see, and Cecil's quite interesting because we've been keeping an eye on this for the longest time. We came down as low as 55 Rand at some point. At some point, the share price, I think it was last year, maybe even the year before that, was north of 300 Rand. Pre-pandemic, we were at 600 Rand. So to be at 70 Rand, we are celebrating the little things in life because sometimes you need that. You need a bit of positivity to start off your week. We hope you have a great week, folks. The rest of the show, as always, will be out later in the week. In our deep dive, we take a look at the gambling industry in South Africa. And in our Investor Insights, we look forward to the Finance Magnates Africa Summit. You want to tune in for those. You want to find out what we're discussing there. But that's Market Matters. This week, we are diving into something special requested by our community. Shout out to one of our community members, Faisal Ngobeni, for asking us to take a look at the gambling industry in South Africa and see what our thoughts are around that. Now, Sai and I have briefly spoken about this and around whether or not we should cover this and how it kind of fits into the landscape of other things like financial markets, where you might be saying that some of the other financial markets exercises are also considered gambling. But we're specifically going to be looking at the rise in gambling that we've seen, and we're going to be taking a look at just what to make of that and how to deal with that. Interesting statistic from the National Gambling Board to kick us off is that between April 2023 and March 2024, South Africans spent 1.1 trillion rand in the local gambling market.
I need to lie down.
And gross gambling revenue increased by 25.7% to 59.3 billion rand. So gambling revenues that the service providers would have seen as inflows into their businesses. Now, there are various things that we're going to get into from a gambling perspective. I mean, obviously, we're going to start off with your initial thoughts, Sai, after you get up from your little lie down. But I want to look at things like regulation around gambling, look at what companies are doing from a marketing perspective. We've seen a lot of one of the gambling companies sponsors our South African National Premier League, right? So those sorts of things. But I suppose let's start with what we make of the gambling space.
It sucks. You know what? So I don't know if you've seen, and I don't even know which gambling site it is. It truthfully doesn't matter. They come up all over my Twitter streams at times, and they're like, oh, so-and-so put down 10 Rand and made 200,000. Imagine if a stockbroker did that. Mm. The FSCA would shut them down before they had, like before that tweet had even got halfway around the world. They would be shut down by regulators, etc. Now, can you turn 10 Rand into 100,000? Sure.
Yes.
Often, no, just not like viable. It preys on poorer people more, I suspect, because it's the instant gratification. I was chatting to someone again in the FSP space recently, and she was, you know, who are our competitors and how do we? And I said, look, the problem is your competitors in the low income space, truthfully, well, not even in the mid income, are the gambling sites. And the trick is a gambling site can promise, and they do, rich by weekend, whereas the FSP is like rich by retirement. I mean, who wants to wait for retirement when it can be weekend? It is, I suspect, disproportionately small people with small amounts of money to whom 20 Rand is a shot at something or dinner tonight. Mm. And then there's the dodgy thing. So way back before online gambling, so this is the casinos in the 90s, there was a parent who had left their kid because the kid couldn't go into the casino area. So then like that shopping area, had left their kid for 9 hours while they were gambling. And the casino was very, very upset because this is child abuse. And so they banned the person for 1 week. 1 week.
1 week. A whole child, week.
A whole week. And then there is a friend I have who's very good at betting on the T20s and makes money. So they shut his account. No, man, this stuff is criminal.
So, yeah. So, I mean, initial thoughts, obviously, there's a couple of areas where we can discuss around overlap as well, mm-hmm. around how 10 Rand can turn into 10,000 Rand, the same way you can do that on a trading account. Both gambling and the trading space kind of offer a leverage element to them. But again, one is distinctly regulated. The other is I need to apply for a gambling board license and then I can really kind of do what I want. Some more interesting statistics around the gambling space. The company called Supergroup, parent company of Betway, right? They're listed on our...
Not anymore.
Not that...
Oh, not that Supergroup.
Not that Supergroup. Okay. Different Supergroup, actually. Yeah, different Supergroup. They now generate most of their earnings from the African market. And this speaks to what you mentioned, Sai, around the desperation that is coming through from a gambling perspective. Mm. If we look at average monthly income for one of the gambling institutions, they basically surveyed their customers. Average monthly income, 16,700 odd rands. Average monthly spend that they then spend on the same platform is around 3,000 Rand. So, I mean, even if you kind of say 16,000 to 4,000, 25% or whatever, you're spending more than 20% on the gambling side of things of average income. Again, this is whether we're looking pre-tax, post-tax, you've got other expenses to get through.
Yeah,
in life.
Yeah.
But I think for me, the main thing is it's the circumstances that people have been placed into. Right. So you're in a country where jobs are not being created. The unemployment rate has just gone up mm-hmm, again mm-hmm. and there's no opportunity sets. And so you're sitting there saying, if I take the 350 Rand that I'm given and I put it down and I make some money, that chance is more than what I might make if I put the 300 Rand into an ETF that I have to wait 10 years for kind yeah. of thing, right? Yeah, so yeah. I have immediate needs that I need to then meet now and I might not have the... And it's not necessarily just unemployed people. It's people that struggle to make it to the end of the month as well. It's say, I mean, I go out and I buy a Powerball ticket. That's gambling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's to say that what I am hopeful for on this side versus my current situation, I can change my current situation if I were to win something. Now, obviously, the gambling houses prey on that. They yeah. rely on you having that mindset because that's when they market products to you. And I suppose this is where the marketing conversation comes in, is that should they be allowed to market? I'm thinking about mm-hmm. Marlboro and the cigarette companies that were banned from marketing in Formula One. Remember there was a time where the Ferrari was branded Marlboro at the back and you had all of that
and
stuff.
And there was the JP Lotus, whatever it
That's
was.
That's it.
JP.
And there was, I think there was Stuyvesant as well. And mm-hmm. and then suddenly tobacco companies were banned from marketing. Should we do that in South Africa? Is that something that will have an impact of any kind? I mean, there are so many gambling companies. Some of them don't even market in South Africa and they still have business. Would changing the marketing even have a difference?
So, I mean, should we ban gambling advert marketing? Yes. Would it have a difference? It must have. I don't know to what degree. But certainly, I mean, it is just all over the place in terms of, I mean, what was it? Was it, it was the Olympics last year. So I don't typically watch, I don't have DSTV, but my wife and I subscribed during the Olympics. And I was just amazed at the frequency of the betting adverts, the billboards all over town. I imagine they're all over the wireless. Again, I'm not much of a wireless listener. Put it this way, if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it. Right. So it must be working. They must be getting an ROI on the money that they spend on their marketing. So, I mean, should we ban it? I mean, sure.
And that marketing now extends to other areas like sponsorships.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So I want to look at that because we've got t-shirt sponsors. You've got guys that are sponsoring an entire league. The Premier League in South Africa is sponsored by a gambling company. And that's obviously from the sporting side of it is one thing, right? People place bets on sporting activities.
Fun fact, Cricket SA has an Indian betting company sponsoring them.
Mm-hmm.
Hansi Kunia, anyone?
Ooh.
Haven't we been down this road before?
Wow, that came out of a very old Pandora's box of sorts. But yes, the EPL, they've looked at banning front of shirt sponsorships from 2026. But it's not just the front of the shirt that's visible, you know what I mean? So it's like, oh, we want to ban it, but we still want the revenue, we still want the money. And betting companies are also willing to pay for the advertising space because they see the ROI, as you're saying. I mean, if I'm putting down $1 million or $2 million or whatever, if I'm willing to put up that kind of money, I'm obviously assuming I'm going to recoup that money back. There's no way I would, in my right mind as a business, put down that kind of marketing spend if I don't think I'm going to get it back.
100%. And I remember it was the Benson and Hedges 50 over cricket, white ball cricket tournament in the late 80s. And then cigarette advertising was getting banned and everyone was like, cricket will die. There won't be any more. And well, it's still there because you know what? Okay, so alcohol stepped into the breach. Another, we'll park that one. But the telcos and suddenly it turns out there were other peeps, the banks. I mean, it turns out there were a lot of other peeps prepared to throw money at it.
It was confirmed by the Betway CEO that it is the single biggest investment in South African sport. Guess the amount, Si.
Over 5 years.
The entire deal, yes. I think it's a three-year. No, it's a three-year deal.
Half a billion.
900 million. Just under
300 million a year.
300 million a year in whatever, whether it's branding, rights, whatever it is. But for you to set up that kind of deal clearly means you believe you're going to make that money back and then some.
And then some. Yeah, and then some. Yeah,
I
was thinking for 20 million a year to sponsor the PSL, I mean, we could pass around the hat and almost do it.
We could generate that kind of money. We could find the money.
What would we call it?
I don't know, actually. Insider exchange. There we go. I want to look at the regulatory side of it in a bit. Things around consumer protection. We've got the Consumer Protection Act. Gambling in South Africa is regulated by the National Gambling Board, and you have to kind of be registered. Now, it's interesting where something like an FSP kind of all sits within the FSCA. The gambling side of it sits within different provinces. So the Mpumalanga Gambling Council or Board versus the Western Cape Gambling Council Board, those are two different entities.
And you go to the one that's most likely to license you because once you registered in Mpumalanga, you can have your online app being used by someone in North Cape.
So you're not restricted depending on where you've registered, but you might have easier conditions for registration in one jurisdiction or the other, as you said. Now, how do we then look at it from a regulatory standpoint? What should be done? Because it's not enough to simply say, oh, let's have under 18 restriction on gambling and all of that. If someone is 17 versus the 3 months after they turn 18, that person doesn't suddenly change and become a completely different person because their birth date is now something different, right?
Yeah.
So how do you now use the law to protect people? Because in South Africa in particular, I mean, we've seen an increase in the number of people that I gave you those stats at the start of the piece. But also we're seeing that this is not going to go away anytime soon. How do you now protect people?
So I think a couple of things. And I think in some ways to kind of bring it into financial service providers, not because they offer the same service, but because there is money involved and lives can be damaged and promises can be made. I think the first is I think there should just be a blanket ban on their ability to market their product. If someone wants to gamble, they will find you. You don't need to go out and spend the 300 million on the PSL every year. But then I think there should be more. They must have. They have a humongous amount of data on their various different clients. They must be able to put some smart logic, AI, machine learning, something at it. They must be able to spot people who are potentially struggling. Mm-hmm. They must be able to spot people who... I mean, for, as one example, I try to take $500 out of my credit card and it's declined. But then 3 days later, after payday, I put the $500 and it's like, okay. So they, you know, there's stuff that you can pick up quite simply. Almost a compliance officer embedded in those organizations who says you need to be doing more to protect your customer. And as I'm saying that, I'm realizing it is so nanny state, but gambling ruins lives.
Yeah. So, and I mean, this is not just the sports betting and those sorts of things. They are full on casinos.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And
the one interesting... is apparently you try to keep a plane afloat or something.
Okay.
And you win money. I don't.
So again, perhaps we'll look at that before we wrap up is the gamification side of it, the gamification of gambling. Mm-hmm. But from a compliance officer perspective, as you mentioned, a lot of these companies, a lot of the casinos put out a thing that says, oh, here's a voluntary exclusion thing where you can go and say you're an at-risk person and then you can voluntarily exclude yourself from the gambling world and all of that. And then you also see guys promote National Responsible Gambling Council. There's a whole number and all of those sorts of things. But at the same time, nobody, the viewpoint from the service providers and the service providers being the gambling houses, the gambling companies is we're not forcing you to do this. We just happen to be putting it kind of in your face.
Sure, but it's an addictive, dangerous product.
Yeah, but also with guys like the casinos, not only do we know it's addictive and that we do subtle things. We remove all clocks from inside of a casino floor so you don't know what time it is. We create ambient lighting. We create perfect ambient temperature so you don't feel too hot or too cold. So we inherently do all of those things. But no, we're not the ones that force you to come and lose money or create that addictive environment for you. That's just the risk that you're almost saying it's not really our responsibility to do that. And perhaps that's where you're bringing the point to say there should perhaps be someone who is held responsible within the company for that. Si, before we run out of time, let's look at the gamification of it. Yeah. Like you said, there's a plane, there's a do this with the plane, you get to win something. I don't know what it is. I'll go find it. how do we, because gamification now means that I can target a younger audience. I can target an audience that might be more susceptible to gaming, whether it's online gaming, whether it's gaming on cell phones, those ads that pop up in between games, those sorts of things. Because for an ad to pop up on a cellular device, the cellular device can belong to an adult. It can belong to a Simon. And Simon could give the phone to his niece or his nephew, and the niece or nephew could be underage, suddenly seeing this gamification thing. And that's a completely different thing, right? So yeah, there might not be any harm done at that time, but gamifying gambling is another thing that seems to be happening.
Yeah, and I mean, to the point, so I found the plane game. Apparently it's quite popular. It's on many of the big ones. You place a bet, plane takes off, multiplier increases as the plane ascends. It represents how much a bet can be multiplied if you cash out before the plane crashes or flies away. This is Candy Crush. Look, I've never played Candy Crush either, but this is essentially Candy Crush, right?
Okay.
And it is that gamification. And to the point, because it's in the online environment, very different to going to a casino. Casinos have friction. You've got to get there.
Security. Yeah. You've got to get through ID checkpoints.
And you've got to physically get to the casino sort of stuff.
Yes.
This is just, I mean, and they can properly gamify it. They know, they probably also got their entrails all over your phone. Mm. They know when you're, you know, doom scrolling, so they Twitter or Facebook, so they quickly pop you with something. They know when your payday is because they can see the deposits. Notwithstanding, they might be seeing the alerts in your phone, because to be clear, apps can have insane access into your phone.
Mm.
They know all of that thing. So they know when, how, and the like. And they've got two things. They've got huge data sets, so they know what the average is. But then they also got that individual. You've logged on. Now, maybe you've given the phone to your niece or your cousin or something, but they know that you've just logged on to something. They know what time's best to hit you. They know that Tuesday evenings don't work, but Thursdays are great.
But we've also made it easy, Si. in that I can top up my gambling account from inside my banking app. They're added as almost public beneficiaries, so it's even more seamless and streamlined to be able to do that. We've seen the likes of SunBet come out and say they're going digital as well because of the pandemic. Obviously, that forced them to look at their business model a little differently. So even the casino in its traditional sense is now migrating to a digital space. But then how do you protect yourself from a digital context? How do we make it harder in the digital world to access?
Because in the real world, for example, limited payout machines, exactly as they say, limited payout, etc., which is Gold Rush, which I'm still not a fan of, but is a lot less of a issue. It comes down to it is a dangerous, addictive product, and we allow those in the world. We have coffee, tobacco, alcohol, and others. We do allow them, but we put a lot of restrictions around them because we're a democracy and we have freedoms, etc. Now, I think, don't touch my tobacco and alcohol, which means I can't ban gambling.
Yeah, but at the same time, I hear what you're saying. So you're saying that if I'm addicted to coffee versus I'm addicted to gambling, and I go down a dark spiral, there's a limit to the amount of coffee cups my body can physically handle. There's no limit to the amount of money I could actually lose.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not clear, the same for these companies to come back and say, oh, but yes, there are addictive things like smoking. There's a limit to how many cigarettes you can smoke a day. No. Yes, if you want to be that person that gets through 3 packs a day, by all means, go smoke 60 cigarettes a day. That's you know what I mean? But in the gambling space, I lose the money. I go and borrow money. I go and get into more debt to fuel this thing. And steal money. I sell things. I sell valuable possessions. I sell investments. It's one of those addictive markets that isn't the same as the other addictive markets per se.
And then there are other addictive markets such as heroin and coke, I'm aging myself because I don't know what the new age drugs are for the kids these days. But there are other, and those we are quite happy to outlaw. So, I mean, it's just governments move so incredibly slowly. The industry will push back with their $300 million a year to throw at the PSL. They can easily throw another $300 million collectively to push back on
it. Yeah, and say, look, we're empowering a league. We're creating jobs for the league. The league employs people, and therefore our contributions allow that league to continue. So yes, there's plenty of ways to kind of appeal to whether or not this is justified or not. But I think there's also that conversation that needs to be had around how do we protect the vulnerable, and how do we protect everybody in general from not just one addictive environment, but also a space that in some countries is very predatory. An industry in some countries is very predatory, where they have, you think about a city like Las Vegas, it's known for that.
Yeah.
For gambling, for the casinos, for that Las Vegas strip that has all of those big MGM Grand casinos. The same with a place like Macau in
China.
In China, right? Known for the same sorts of things. So even within the gambling space, there are places where people kind of go to. But I think from a gambling industry, particularly as how it affects South Africa, the concerns are obviously targeting the vulnerable, targeting the young, those that are desperate to change financial situations, which we all are. I mean, the cost of living is not an
no
easy
one doesn't
exercise,
want another
right?
10 rand into 100.
That's it. Nobody, there's no one out there who, given the opportunity to make R1 million, is going to say, oh no, I'm okay, thanks.
Yeah, I'm busy
I don't
that
want
day.
That. I'm busy that day, you know? Mm-hmm. But there's a way to do it, I suppose. And I guess we don't have the answers around how to make everything safer. And I guess that's where the power of the community comes in, is that we can share our thoughts, we can share our insights, we can share our inspiration around this. And interestingly enough, I want to leave this on this kind of note around certain countries, mostly Middle Eastern countries. But the UAE has a completely banned state on gambling. And to the extent that I think they are building a casino for the first time in Dubai, and they're building it a certain distance out into the ocean. I don't know if that classifies as international waters or whatever, but they are doing that. I think it's about 5 kilometers away from the shoreline and all of that. So I don't know if that's the reason behind it, but there's a total ban on gambling in the UAE. There's a total ban in Qatar. It's banned in Brunei. It's banned in North Korea. But most things are banned in North Korea.
Yeah. What we could do is ban marketing and then restrict hours.
Restrict hours and say what? You have to conclude.
I don't know. Do you?
So it's similar to how liquor licenses expire at a certain time.
Well, do you have to shut at 10 and open at 5? Or do you only allow 2 hours a day on the app? See, it's all just so draconian.
It becomes a lot, yeah.
It's so anti... I mean, I'm very big on free will, but yo.
But the start of it might just be that, might just be restricting the access to it, restricting the marketing, restricting how often it's in everybody's faces. And that might be a good first step.
Yeah.
Community out there, we'd love to know your thoughts around what other steps can be taken, what other measures can be taken to protect individuals from the gambling industry. And if you believe that the gambling industry should be left alone, let us know your thoughts around that as well. Because for some people, they might say, look, everybody has free will. This is a demand-supply economy. If someone wants to access the product, then the person supplying the product has done nothing wrong. So we'd love to get your thoughts around that as well, and perhaps your viewpoint on that. But we're going to leave the deep dive on that note, and we're going to get into our investor insights. And to wrap things up with our investor insights, we're taking a look at a very special event coming up later this month. In fact, coming up next week, that is the Finance Magnates Africa Summit. And thank you to the team at Finance Magnates. They've graciously agreed to partner with us on this event. We've got a big announcement around that towards the end of the conversation, but we've got a special in-studio guest joining us to take a look at this event and take a look at its importance. You might remember Rob Van Aden from one of our previous episodes. He's been in studio with us before. He is, of course, the author of Badass Trader. We've spoken to him about the book. We've spoken to him about some markets. This time, we're going to be taking a look at the Finance Magnates Summit that's coming up next week. Rob, you and I are both traveling down to Finance Magnates, and I'm looking forward to that. But perhaps let's kind of take it from why this matters. You've been in the trading game and in the financial space for a really long time, possibly one of the few people that have may have been around longer than Cy. I'm not sure. We'll do the math on that. But
no math required.
No math required. But why is an event like this so important?
Yes, Jimmy. Thank you for inviting me this morning. I think the event is important from the perspective that it provides an opportunity for new traders, existing traders, and seasoned traders, firstly, to get together. It's a very large community, but it's a very fragmented community in South Africa, and it provides a wonderful opportunity to meet and greet. For me, the biggest thing about Finance Magnates is basically for traders to learn from other traders and other market experts. There's a lot of information out there, and I'm embarrassed to say, actually, you know, with all of the information, the numbers haven't shifted. We're still seeing that 71% of traders do not make it. We know that over a period of 4 years, only about 1% survive. And when I chatted last time to you about prop trading, it seems the ratios are even more horrendous there, with a success rate of 4%. So there's a lot of information out there, but we know what we know, but we keep on doing what we know. And hopefully this Finance Magnates would highlight a lot of things. There's a wonderful host of people presenting and sharing stories as well. And I think the big message, which I hope people get from Finance Magnates, is that, yes, trading is hard, but it can be done, and it can be done successfully.
Speaking of sharing stories, you and I are on a all-star panel where we will be sharing some of our fondest stories, both good and bad, from a trading sense. I wish Cy would be on that panel as well, because you've got a wealth of knowledge around just some of those stories. And I want to look at just the value of that, the value of experience, and the value of being able to tell someone else about your scars and your mistakes so that they don't have to make the same mistakes.
Yeah, it's a good thing, because, you know, I think I wrote about it in the book as well. I have blown up 3 accounts myself. So I think it's a rite of passage. It seems that you have to blow up account 1 or 2 or 3. Hopefully not more than 3. So I'll be sharing my insight in terms of what turned the needle for me. I was introduced to 2 mentors, a lady out of Australia, and then I'll mention it. I can't mention his real name, and people might be surprised, but he used to go under the name of Jack Shark. So that should be intriguing enough, what the lessons I learned from Mr. Jack Shark. All I can share with you was a Chicago Pits trader. I got on by accident on a Facebook group about 5 years ago, and there were 4 of us, and Jack was our mentor. And Jack shared a lot of information, which I have still not seen today in terms of risk management, viewing the market, and he even went as far as affirmations in terms of what you should do before trading, which I've also not picked up before. So I'm looking forward, if I get to ask the question about Jack, I'll share some of Jack Shark's wisdom.
Si, your war stories, I know you might not be sharing those at the summit, but surely you have a bag full of them, both good and bad.
Yeah, so can I tell you the good one? Because those are the nice ones. I bought a little warrant. 1DBR was the code. And about 5 minutes later, I checked. And to be clear, to buy the warrant, I used to have to telephone my broker. It was olden days. And it was De Beers. And there was the takeout announcement. And my warrant like tripled in price in about 5 minutes. And about 10 minutes later, I got a call from Peter Redman at the JSC. Was it Peter Redman? Surveillance.
Wow.
I'm like, trust me, gent, I know nothing. I'm just some little oak down in the hills of KZN.
I'm trying something new.
trying something new. It was just one of those weird things. And it was just pure dumb luck. But that, to the point, is the point with trading is discipline and money management, risk management, position size, stop loss, all of those boring things. And occasionally you get unlucky. And because of those in place, those don't hurt too much. And then occasionally you get lucky and you 3x. Now, if I had put my entire net worth into it on that trade, I wouldn't be here today. I would have bought an island somewhere. But again, it's about that risk component and making sure that you've got good risk, because you're not focusing on the winners. You're focusing on making sure the losers don't bust you out. Because I spent 5 years losing money as a trader. Partly I was trading equities, because in the mid 90s, there wasn't much beyond that. There was Aussie futures, but that scared me. And then warrants arrived in October 97. So I thought, oh, let me trade options. I'm losing on equity. So what did option trading do? Accelerated my losses. No one was surprised except me.
So there's definitely a lot to learn from things like past experiences, especially with how times have changed. And I want to kind of look at that as well as we look forward to this summit. I mean, it is the third time that they're having the summit on the African continent, but already it is the largest gathering of its kind on the continent. And something you mentioned, Si, it's around risk that's important in financial markets. But something both you gentlemen have seen as well is it's around regulation as well. And we've seen many different colors of regulation. And I've got a regulatory panel that I'm going to be hosting at Finance Magnates. And I want to kind of just get a sense of how far we've come from the days of the phone trader to the days of sitting on an actual trading desk, which I don't think too many companies still have, but also to where we are now with things like ODP and how important regulation becomes in a world where people are supposedly losing more money than making.
Yeah, it's changed a hell of a lot. I think in the last 3-4 months, it's accelerated quite a lot quickly in South Africa. And two things that have happened. The first is basically there's been a clampdown on signal providers, which aren't FSPs. So we've been seeing fines coming through. We've been seeing 15-year disbarments coming through, which is a good thing, because a lot of these unregulated financial advisors have put inverted commas focus on the vulnerable. And the FSCA have made it very clear that, you know, it's totally against them. So that is a good thing. So I think in terms of what has also added in the last couple of years, when Simon and myself were trading, the word compliance officer was totally unheard of. It just started. It wasn't, it was more of a paper pusher, checking your ID, your bank statements. And then with the ODP add-on for some of the FSPs, you need to add a full-time risk manager as well. So there's a double set of eyes in terms of running the business. So that's the one thing that changed quite a lot. And then in the beginning of the year, the FSCA came out with Education Standard 1 of 2025. So there's a huge focus in terms of financial education and financial literacy. And look, there's still grayness in the regulation in terms of is education, should it be regulated or not? But they've made it very clear, if you're a financial services provider and you provide education, by the end of next year, you need to have a lot of things in regulation, a lot of things in place in terms of offering financial education. So the FSCA, they've been busy for many years in terms of promoting financial literacy and financial education. It's now galvanized in the first standard. So that's a massive change, from where Simon and myself came along from, no compliance officers, no risk managers, to regulated FSPs, signal providers suddenly as well, because in the days we could provide trade ideas. You can still provide trade ideas as an FSP. They're not stopping that as well. But there's a lot of regulation around it. So I think the two areas where they are focusing at the moment, where, as I mentioned, where it is a bit gray, is about is providing education. And then these expert advisors advisors or AI bots or whatever fancy term you want to call it.
Sai, your take on just how important it is to think about things like regulation, especially if you are, as Rob mentioned, I mean, you're coming to a summit where it is every trader, every broker that wants to get your business. You might be new to trading, you might be a seasoned expert, you might have your own questions and things, but this is, I suppose, the one kind of event where you can come in and say, yes, these are the questions I've always wanted to know the answers to.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, it's, I mean, going through the speaker list, this is a who's who's of people who know what they're doing and have, to Rob's point, got the scars and come through the other side. And I think these sort of events, I'm a huge fan of them. I think they can be hugely empowering. I think they can be immensely useful for those going, not to get, you know, not to go and, wow, let's, you know, find a way to get rich quick, but just to get simple stuff and ideas. And my view is always twofold. Firstly, trading in of itself is not hard. It's buying and selling. No rocket science required. Trading in of itself is the hardest thing you're ever going to do because your head's going to explode. And my point at these type of events is don't go and try and leave as an expert trader. Just go and try and find one or two things that you can implement into your process, your thinking, your skill set that move you forward as a trader. And I know people are like, oh, it's a two-day event. Just that. Just try and find one or two things that make you a better trader. Whenever I read a book or have a conversation or go to an event like that, that's always my aim. And to be clear, we're always getting better and just trying to sort of master it and get a step further and a step further, not to sort of think that you can go to a two-day event and you will be trader on Monday morning.
Absolutely. And I think with what you're saying, Sai, it's so important that we're constantly learning in incremental bits and not trying to learn everything at once. And Rob, I know you touch on that in your book. I know in Badass Trader, you take a look at the different steps in the journey, what it takes to actually keep moving within that. And that's something you're going to be bringing to FMAS this year as well. You're going to be discussing that at the event, and you're going to be doing something very special for the audience that's going to be there. But I want to kind of just get a sense from an overall perspective around just what are you looking forward to about next week? I mean, you and I are going to have plenty of discussions with plenty of people and all of that, but what's the one thing that you're saying that, as I mentioned, I mean, if there's one thing you're looking forward to imparting on someone that's attending, what's that going to be?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. You know, as Simon said, it's trading is probably one of the easiest things and probably one of the hardest things. If there's one message I want to get across, is basically focusing on being right versus making money. There's this huge focus with retail traders to be right, and it doesn't always make money. So that would be my focus on my message. And I actually, in the slides that I've prepared, I go into it. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing, you know, people want to be right. They don't want to make money, which is weird. So in my presentation, I'll focus on that. I'll share the statistic of 71%. I'll share the statistic of the 1990 rule. I won't give it away now.
Of course.
Of course. And then, you know, at the end, I think one of the requests from the organizers was, you know, the book has been written about 2 years ago. What are the kind of questions I've been getting, you know, since the last 2 years? And a lot of them are the same. You know, it's you know, first of all, it's being right versus making money. You need an edge to trade successfully. You need to manage your emotions. And then I'll stop on a topic which you requested me a while back with Simon to talk about as prop trading. Okay, look, it is a mechanism of getting capital, but the statistics are horrendous out there. You know, 40% pass the challenges, and then once 90% fail the challenges, and then once they are funded, 40% only succeed. So if you add those two up, you're sitting with a success rate of 4%. So I will go into what it takes to become a funded trader with a reputable prop shop.
There it is. There's the key word there, folks. It's reputable. But we're going to leave that teaser on that note. The Finance Magnates Africa Summit is taking place next week on the 29th and the 30th of May at the CTICC in Cape Town. We thank the Finance Magnates team, the team at Ultimate FinTech, for partnering with us on this. And that partnership is that announcement that I promised you at the start of our show. It is that Insider Exchange is the official podcast partner for Finance Magnates Africa Summit this year. So we're going to be there. We're going to be answering some of your questions. We're going to be speaking to executives such as Rob and some of the other speakers that are going to be there. As I said, I'm on a couple of panels as well. So you'll be getting some insights from me around some of the stories that I have to share and some of the insights that we have. So if you haven't already booked your ticket, you can still go and register for that. You can still go on to the Finance Magnates Africa Summit website and get your ticket. It is free to attend this event. So we're giving you all of this knowledge that we have, that we've accumulated all for free, and you have to do absolutely nothing for it other than attend. If you are outside of Cape Town and unable to attend, tune into Insider Exchange. Obviously, we'll have you covered from that perspective, and we'll be bringing you some of those insights. Rob, thanks so much for joining us in studio. We're going to definitely have a lot of fun and a lot of conversations next week. We're going to leave our investor insights on that note. We're going to be taking a look at what we want to be adding to our wall. And while we have Rob in studio, we're going to get his thoughts on that. United Health, the healthcare company that had its CEO, I don't want to say mysteriously unalived. It wasn't really mysterious. It happened.
Dropped in the back of the head on CCTV.
And the subsequent fallout of that has been absolutely crazy. I mean, the stock has been down following a poor set of numbers that came out after the CEO's passing, I suppose. And since then, the stock's down a further, I think, 30%. So it's down about more than 50% year to date. Rob, is that something you would have on your kind of or in your portfolio if you could?
Well, personally, I do not trade like that. So my own trading methodology would be an open range breakout. And then at my end of the day, it would be basically a breakout method as well. So for the breakout method to work, there needs to be volume increase and it needs to have a positive breakout. So those kind of news events I would not be looking at, but I can understand if you're fundamentally following this company or you follow a different methodology that this would impact. You know, even though some CEOs get it wrong, but you know, it's better to know the devil than don't. And then, you know, with a bad set of results, it's like a double whammy. So I can understand why the stock took there's just too much uncertainty, and markets don't like uncertainty, even though results weren't great and maybe it's a questionable CEO, but you know, markets do like certainty. So my own trading, it probably would have not come on my watch list, nor on my scan list, nor as a signal. Also, I trade, you know, I trade large gap shares for liquidity reasons. So I probably would haven't seen that coming.
Si, you just don't like healthcare stocks.
Nope. I like healthcare, but not healthcare stocks. And there's a couple of, I mean, there's all the R&D and all of that. Yeah, that's fine. They earn it back. What bothers me with healthcare stock is that the cost of healthcare has been rising well ahead of inflation the world over. And at some point, governments, and to be clear, most governments are the buyers of healthcare services in Europe and places like that where they have state healthcare. And at some point, the government comes to you and says, about that nice profit you got there, shame if something were to happen to it, which is essentially what Trump said, 2 weeks ago or so. And to be clear, he's not wrong. I mean, in this particular point, American healthcare is immensely expensive. And I've always just been concerned about the regulatory environment. And I remember if we go back 20 plus years with the ARVs, and I forget who the company was who had the patents and everything. And to get ARVs in South Africa was about 15,000 rand per person per month. Governments of India, Brazil, South Africa went to them and said, look guys, it's really, really simple. You give us a better price or we will reverse engineer it and make it on our own and let you sue us and in your court documents say that dead people are fine. And they folded like a house of cards and ARVs cost 2 rand. Per person per month. And to be clear, they still make money on that. It's above cost of production. And you know, someone's going to discover a cure for Alzheimer's and different cancers and the like, and they'll have a short window until South Africa, Brazil, India come knocking on your door. I don't like healthcare stocks. One exception is the likes of Skylar and stuff. We make the beds nice and easy. And maybe even the folks who do the robotic surgery and stuff. But healthcare, I stay away.
Let's be clear. We added Johnson & Johnson to our wall of preferred picks, but that was entirely because it was a dividend aristocrat that had paid dividends for 60 plus years in a row. And so therefore, that made sense. What are we doing with United Healthcare? Are we even considering putting it anywhere on our wall?
Do we have a stay the heck away from section?
Yep, we do. then we actually do.
And to be clear, Johnson & Johnson is healthcare, but it's like it's not the cutting edge drugs and that sort of stuff.
Okay, so we know where we're putting United Healthcare. It is stay as far away from that as possible, and that is going to be our preferred pick for this week. We're going to leave the show on that note. Rob, thanks again for joining us in studio, and we will not leave the show without giving you an unfiltered opinion. This week's unfiltered opinion of the week is a quote from Mozart in the Jungle that says, you say amateur as if it's a dirty word. Amateur comes from the Latin word amare, which means to love, to do things for the love of it. So maybe being an amateur isn't so bad. That's our unfiltered opinion of the week, and that's where we're leaving it. Until next time, investing isn't hard. Just try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.